Case number 14-3060, United States of America versus Queen NOA Appellant. Mr. Kramer for the appellant, Ms. Seifert for the appellee.
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. In the first appeal of this case, in its brief on appeal, the government said that Ms. Inouye's testimony about the beating she had suffered, the control she had suffered, the financial control that Mr. Osuagu had over her was irrelevant because she had raised no issue about a battered woman defense. The government, as a matter of fact, said notably Ms. Inouye had not raised a battered woman defense. And then on appeal in this court said the same thing. The court talked about the mere whiff of a battered woman defense. I'm not sure what that is exactly, but in any event, they said that she had not raised.
Where there's a very short relationship between the woman and the alleged batterer, and there are large periods of time when they're separate from one another during his crime.
Well,
could that be when that occurs?
Well, that would not be this case then.
It wouldn't?
No, because they were.
Perhaps I read the wrong record.
During the period of the conspiracy that was charged, there was no evidence that he was away at all during that time period. And nor was it a brief relationship. I mean, it lasted about 7 months or more.
7 months.
But
how long was the L.A. conspiracy?
48 days.
48 days.
Yes. And the not 2 months or spanning, it was 48 days, the government told the district court. But in any event, having said all of that, now the government on appeal in this court saying that BWS was not presented as a defense. And that was a direct result of the ineffectiveness of Ms. Inouye's trial counsel. As Judge Friedman said, he just didn't do what he should have. But now everybody says it's irrelevant.
Now you film on quorum notice, right?
Well, I think it's actually properly brought under habeas because of the Supreme Court's decision that says people who have been excluded from the United States may bring habeas. This seems, if anything, being people who are not allowed into the United States but can travel to the rest of the world, whereas Ms. Inouye would be excluded from the United States. So I think it's properly brought under. The government says it's properly brought. It doesn't say under which one, but I think it's properly brought under either or both, frankly. Although, if it's properly brought under habeas, it can't be brought under quorum nobis. Yes, that's
quorum
a substitute.
Quorum nobis lies only in extraordinary case, and if the other remedy is not available. And I'm wondering if this lapse of counsel is sufficiently extraordinary to come back after your case is otherwise over.
Well, first of all,
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I probably gave you some dead air. Go ahead, man.
I guess two things. First of all, the government hasn't disputed that it's properly brought under. They don't say which one, but they say, in a footnote they say it's properly brought. And there's case law cited in my brief that says claims of ineffective assistance of counsel and claims of removal or deportation, as it's called, constitute the sufficient circumstances for quorum nobis relief. So I think the government hasn't disputed it in this, nor is any contrary case law cited, and there's ample case law to support that a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel in general, as well as a claim of removal deportation, is properly brought under quorum nobis. But I actually think it's properly brought under habeas in any event. But according to the government and the district, this court on appeal, not supplied any evidence about battered women syndrome, now the record is replete with evidence of battered women syndrome. Not only in general, Dr. Jinta testified at length both about battered women syndrome in general and about the fact that Ms. Inouye suffered from battered women syndrome. The government didn't present any contrary evidence, but didn't even challenge, really, Dr. Jinta's testimony. So now Judge Friedman said that the trial counsel was deficient in that not asking for CJA funds for an expert and not exploring and not properly advising Ms. Inouye about the need for an expert. But somehow all this testimony that the government, in its brief on the first appeal, said there was no such testimony, so there couldn't have been any. And this court pointedly noted what was lacking in this case was expert witnesses testifying to the effects of isolation, financial dependence, or estrangement from family members. That's exactly what Dr. Ginter provided that her counsel, that Mr. Noe's trial counsel, had failed to provide, and now all of a sudden Judge Friedman finds that that wouldn't have made any difference. I would have made, remembering that one member of this court in the panel opinion found that the duress instruction should have been given even without the expert testimony.
That's called a dissent. That tells you what the law is.
That is a dissent, but notably Judge Tatel was on the panel in Gaviria, one of this court's other duress cases. But in any event,
the district judge said in order for the defendant to be entitled to a duress instruction, she must adduce evidence at trial showing that she herself, in fact, had no reasonable legal alternative, objective standard. You want to respond to that?
That's exactly the testimony Dr. Ginter provided, she wrote about reasonable people in a battering relationship. She specifically said Ms. Inouye had no desire to profit from Dr. Iweala. Her participation was against her will, that reasonable people entrapped in a battering relationship act this way Ms. Inouye acted, and a reasonable person can be trapped. Remaining makes more sense than leaving. So she provided the exact testimony.
The district court has essentially adopted a test focused on a reasonable person, meaning someone who is not suffering from a battered woman syndrome.
I think that's the problem. Right.
The in fact makes no sense. If you read the district court's decision, you cannot have a battered woman syndrome defense unless the evidence is someone had a gun at my head when I did what I did. He's essentially wiped it out with the test that he's applied.
I mean, I couldn't agree more. I think that's exactly the problem. And that's what Judge Uvell said when she wasn't given the instructions. She said he didn't have a gun to her head at every second. And that's the problem. That's what the expert testimony provided. She said she had ample opportunity to tell people at work and at school and her family. But Dr. Ginter said that's exactly what battered women do not do.
And,
right. And the cases are legion about these concepts.
I don't understand. I'll hear what the government says. I don't understand the district court's decision because he's essentially wiped out the possibility of the defense. You don't measure reasonableness as against someone who's not a battered woman. That makes no sense. It's like saying a crippled person who's tied up should be able to run because reasonable people can run. It makes no sense whatsoever.
No, I couldn't agree more. And even this court said in its original opinion that you had to take in her particular circumstances. They said you had to evaluate the duress defense. Now, they said because no expert testimony was provided about these things like isolation and financial and the threats. But the cases are legion, saying that a reasonable person in a battered women's situation does not leave. In fact, just the opposite, because they're so frightened, they think that they will be beaten. And in fact, Osuwaru threatened to kill her and bury her in a house where no one else knew where she lived, not even her husband, whom she was separated from, knew where she lived. He threatened to bury her, kill her and bury her in the house. He threatened several times to kill her. He hit her, beat her repeatedly every time she voiced an objection to this scheme. That's exactly what the expert, I mean, the articles, there's an article by a professor who's an expert in battered women syndrome, Mary Ann Dutton, that's cited in my brief, that talks about how a reasonable person would not leave, a reasonable perception of imminent danger and a reasonable perception of lack of alternatives. That's what battered women syndrome is all about. And these are reasonable in the situation they're in. And that's what's, Judge Friedman said the evidence is admissible. He said generalized testimony is admissible, but then he said, I don't really understand. But after that, there's nothing you do with it. It's just there, and it means nothing. So it seems to be even a contradiction in terms that it's admissible, but there's nothing you do with it. So and many of the cases talk about the reasonable perception, too, from the situation. So the fact that This is the evidence that was missing, and Judge
Quinn... You disagree with the Fifth Circuit decision, the 1994 Fifth Circuit decision, then?
The Willis or Dixon?
Yeah, Willis.
I mean, Willis, the thing about Willis is there was extensive testimony about battered woman syndrome admitted in that case, and a duress instruction was given. The Dixon case that followed after that noted Willis, but then said, but generalized testimony about battered woman syndrome is admissible. So the case itself admitted, and not only in Willis did there was the generalized testimony, but there was specific testimony that the woman in Willis did suffer from battered woman syndrome. So it went beyond just the generalized. So I frankly, as I said, the government in this court said in the first appeal, this is the evidence that's lacking. There was no such evidence presented. Now the evidence presented in an uncontroverted...
Counsel, the evidence still is not presented at trial. The opinion is still correct. You're coming in here, perhaps on an extraordinary writ, and saying the evidence is in the record. You have something you put in there to try to support a petition, but that does not gainsay what the court said the first time. There wasn't any such evidence.
No, no, I couldn't agree more, Judge Zintel. You're absolutely right. There was no such evidence presented originally. This court said that's the shortcoming in the case when you... have the mere
and normally web. That's the end of things. You're asking for something exceptional now. You're way beyond.
I don't think it's exceptional to say a defense lawyer should.
You don't think this is an extraordinary case?
No, not
well,
at all.
It's habeas or nothing.
No.
If it's not an extraordinary case, you lose.
Well,
if it's quorum nobis, it has to be extraordinary, right?
But they've defined extraordinary as ineffective assistance of counsel. And or deportation from the United States, both present that kind of extraordinary circumstance. So when you say extraordinary, I've cited the cases in the brief that say ineffectiveness and or deportation satisfies the quorum nobis standard. When I say it's not extraordinary, what I really mean is you had a lawyer who basically fell down in a premise he knew about and did nothing about to try to get the testimony before the court, which would have made the difference in this case. It's clear. I mean, she testified all this, and then there was no instruction and nothing. He wasn't even allowed to argue it in his closing. So I would just ask the court, and again, Judge Sintel, the government hasn't disputed that this case satisfies, not sure which one, but they have just said that they're
that
not.
That would be a jurisdictional question, wouldn't it, Mr. Kramer?
It would be a jurisdictional question.
Yeah,
I think it's
habeas or quorum nobis for us to have jurisdiction to do anything. So whether the government disputes it or not is not assessed.
And this court just recently, in a case, talked about quorum nobis and how quorum nobis is an appropriate vehicle of relief in a case just decided, I think, in November or December, where it talked about a petition for order. Quorum nobis provides a way to collaterally attack a conviction who's no longer in custody. They say extraordinary cases, but then they say, in particular and central to this case, it may be used to redress fundamental errors in criminal proceedings, such as violations of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. That's the Newman case that was decided in November. So that's exactly what this case is about, nor, as I said, has the government disputed it? But I also think it's actually jurisdiction is under habeas, according to the Supreme Court. I think it's the Jennings case back in the 1950, maybe, or I'll look it up, where they said if somebody's been excluded, not allowed to enter the United States, that relief is available under habeas. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Karen Seifert for the United States. The Court of Appeals has already found that the facts in this case did not warrant a duress
instruction.
Let me ask you
first, what do we have jurisdiction under? Is this habeas or is this quorum nobis?
The government's position, as stated in our brief at footnote 10, is that this is a quorum nobis case. There are really no facts at all about the immigration status of this particular individual, and so I don't know how there could be support for the habeas contention that she's subject to deportation proceedings. That factual record was not made below. The government agrees with Your Honor that quorum nobis is a higher standard, but but does think that the claim could be cognizable.
Excuse me for interrupting you, but the jurisdiction should come first. Go ahead.
Certainly, Your Honor. So the only question, though, for this court is whether the addition of general expert testimony fixed the sufficient defect or the particular defects in the factual record, takes it beyond what the district court already found was defective.
That's what we said last time was missing.
I don't agree, Your Honor, that that's what the court said. In fact, the court said that although expert testimony was missing, it also said that there is no evidence about financial dependence, estrangement from family members, and the court goes on to say Ms. Inouye said that she had many alternative sources of protection and support. And that was really key to the court's holding, was she had other friends and family that she had accessibility to.
The court didn't have the battered woman syndrome expert testimony before it, however. Those things are viewed very differently when you look at what an expert says about someone who is a battered woman.
I agree, Your Honor, that the expert...
Because they have an incapacity. So what, that they have money, or so what, they have family? That's the whole point of it.
I understand.
That doesn't help them. The court was principally saying the first time the information, the expert testimony was not there. So that's the proper fight now. And we need to focus on what Judge Friedman said, which I find very perplexing, as I said. He's essentially said, yeah, there was clearly a failing by counsel, but you can't win because you can't prove in fact that she didn't have alternatives. Well, that's totally inconsistent with the battered woman syndrome if you're a victim of it. She didn't have alternatives. If you're a battered woman, you do not perceive you have alternatives.
Two points, Your Honor. First, Judge Friedman's position is completely consistent with the 5th, 9th, and the 11th circuits.
Well, I can give you other circuits that go the other way. So it's a first. It's a question of first impression for us. There are other circuits, and there are many district court cases that go the other way. So why don't we go from there, okay?
Well, it's also consistent with this court's own precedent that the individual who's claiming duress must have, in fact, an opportunity.
So can battered women's syndrome ever be recognized in a duress case?
I think that this court has in its precedent, left open whether on the first prong, whether or not there is a unlawful threat of imminent death, whether that is a subjective or an objective inquiry. Specifically in Jenrette, the court assumed that Congressman Jenrette's fears that were induced by his alcoholism were reasonable, but then went on to say that he, in fact, had other opportunities.
But are you saying, you're not answering Judge Kavanaugh's question.
I was going to say that, too. What is the answer to the question?
So, it could be to the extent on the first prong. I think
No. Is it a viable defense or not? Can it be raised?
No, because on the second prong, it must be in fact.
Yeah, right, is your answer.
No, you're saying.
No, battered women's defense is never a cognizable defense or way to raise a duress defense.
And that's certainly
not
what
completely.
Judge Friedman is saying. Because
certainly.
He's misreading reasonable.
And I don't know how that makes a lot of sense, frankly. Because you're in the circumstance where, as Judge Edwards said, by definition, if you accept the battered woman syndrome testimony, expert testimony, the woman does not have reasonable alternatives.
For one,
even though a person without would have the reasonable alternatives, of course, but as Judge Edwards says, you don't look at the person without, do you?
First, addressing the standard, Your Honor. The court has said, and several other courts have said, that historically the words reasonable and well-grounded, and this is from Castro Gomez in the First Circuit, hypothesizes a defendant of ordinary firmness and judgment and then asks, what would that ordinary person have done in these experiences? The standard is, what would a reasonable person do, not what a reasonable battered woman would do.
Well, I don't understand that. I don't understand that.
Well,
it makes no sense whatsoever.
It's consistent with the proposition that defense is simply not available.
The defense is a historical common law defense that is extremely limited to very...
No, not duress is a better woman, I'm afraid.
Yes.
Duress is a historical common law defense.
Exactly.
Better woman is a more recent thing.
Yes, Your Honor. And it has mostly come up in, obviously, self-defense cases.
Yeah.
But duress, on the other hand, has always been held by this court to only apply in extremely harrowing situations, and it says it has an extremely high bar. Now, I don't agree with Your Honor, Judge Edwards, that the court essentially wiped out the defense. I would point this court to the Ninth Circuit's decision in Johnson. In that case,
you the Sixth Circuit decision. So, and the First Circuit decision.
I would like to hear about the Ninth Circuit.
I'll get to the Sixth Circuit decision in just one moment, Your Honor.
Absolutely.
In Johnson, there were three different women in that case who all said that they wanted to assert a defense of duress. And the court did permit one of them to assert a defense of duress because she actually tried to escape multiple times from her abuser and was either stopped or beaten at the result of her efforts to escape. So the court said she met the literal terms of duress. The other defendants couldn't show that same that they took those opportunities to escape. And the court said, look, they haven't made out a duress claim. And so in Johnson, that's a great case where there's different factual circumstances where a battered woman can say, look, I still qualify for the defense, even though it's not a subjective inquiry.
You have to be able to show you're a woman. I tried, so I got the daylights beaten out of me a few times. That should be good enough. That's like the gun at the head. It really makes no sense. If the battered woman syndrome is what the experts say it is, you are dealing with a woman who does not have the capacity to make the move to leave. Now, whether the person is or is not in that situation, the jury can decide it. But the evidence is absolute. I've read over and over this material. There's no conceivable way that you can say that person has the capacity to make the move. And so what the district court judge did is essentially say there is no such defense here. Unless someone has a gun at the head, that's it.
Not necessarily a gun at the head, but unless there is a short enough immediate need to commit the crime because you have no other choice and no other opportunity.
You're not understanding battered woman syndrome. It's really not that easy.
And Your Honor,
these are people who are living. You said, is it terrorist? It is terror for them. They are being terrorized. They are frozen. And the expert in this case explains how it plays out. They are incapacitated. They've gotten the daylights beaten out of them. The guy has made it very clear. You make a move, you're dead. I mean, I wish I could have the people here lined up. And I don't understand. Judge Friedman credits the first district court judge as having personal knowledge of battered woman, and that's satisfactory to overcome. You let an expert testify, and then you make the judgment. A judge can't say, I know something about something, and that overrides what an expert might say. That's not acceptable.
I think why Judge Huvel did not consider that to be necessary is because the facts of this case, and if I could just have a moment to address what those facts were, did not support Ms. Inouye did not have other opportunities. So one fact that both the Court of Appeals and the District Court found relevant was that in June, while Ms. Inouye was still with her alleged abuser, she made a call to Nigerian officials to report the crime. And she stated her first testimony was she felt that was the, quote, convenient time. She later stated that she was, quote, safe at that point. But in any event, she says when asked why she calls the officials in Nigeria, she says, I know how they work. I know that if I report this, they must do something. That is evidence that she was a woman who understood what other opportunities, legal remedies were available to her.
That's what the first trial judge surmised without the help of an expert. The expert did not say what you're just saying.
The expert actually didn't know about that. She never told the expert that in her time when she testified and told the expert what had happened.
But the question is, given what the expert is saying and what we read in this record now, whether it makes any sense whatsoever for this counsel not to bring an expert before the court and let the expert testify with respect to battered woman syndrome generally and, if permissible, this woman in particular.
I don't think that the question is whether it makes any sense. The question, and it's the appellant's burden to show, that had that expert testified, she would have gotten the instruction, and additionally, a reasonable juror would have voted in her favor.
What you presented there in the terms of the facts might be a reason the jury would discount perhaps the expert testimony. But I don't know that that's a reason not to have the expert testimony in and to assume, as the court before assumed, and as your prior brief assumed, that it was significant that there hadn't been expert testimony.
Well, additionally, Your Honor, there are multiple facts about the very beginning of this case when she makes the first attempt to go get money from Dr. Iwala. She's by herself. The aggressor is not with her. At that point, she actually has not experienced any threat of imminent death. She has been hit. The government does agree with that. But there has been no threat of death or harm. That doesn't come until months later or weeks later in the case.
She's been hit, right?
She has been hit, but
right.
this court has found that's not enough.
How many times do you have to get hit?
Well, according to the record, it has been twice at that point. But my point is...
Are you suggesting that as a medical matter, you have something to show that twice is not enough?
My point is that the courts have routinely required and this is the standard of this court, imminent death or serious bodily injury.
But you've got to put it in the context of a battered woman syndrome, how it is they act. And yet you're suggesting, and I'm not blaming you, but to suggest to me, based on what I'm reading about what experts say, that she was only hit a couple of times, as if that's not enough. I'd like to have some battered woman here to tell you now, oh, no, that's plenty.
I think the question is whether there's a sufficient factual basis that she didn't have, that she was, in fact, at the time of the crimes.
Was a good reason for the attorney not to bring in an expert, to let the expert testify, and then let the jury decide?
Was there a good reason?
That's not your position. You're not taking the position that the attorney was not guilty of failure to adequately represent.
No, the court, the
you're
government
not
doesn't.
That position. You're admitting that the attorney failed to do what he should have done. The question comes at the next step.
The next step.
Right.
We're not conceding deficiency per se because I don't believe that that was found by the trial
you're
court. He stopped short of that. He said that he
are
needed
you conceding,
to.
Well, are you conceding it, though?
No, I think that there needs to be further factual development on the record. For one, the court never found that she was actually eligible for CJA funds, and I think she would need to be eligible for the funds to show that she could have gotten the expert to then show that the expert would have been introduced. So there's still factual development.
I understood your position, and I thought you were conceding at that point.
We conceded it was certainly a mistake not to address it with her, which is exactly what Judge Friedman found. The question of Strickland deficiency requires the court to look at all of the facts and circumstances of trial counsel's entire representation in the case and assess his overall performance. The court did not do that, and I would caution that the better course for this court is, if you find prejudice, to remand to the district court for factual development on that prong. The court never even considered which side of which either the Mr. Iwanage's testimony or Ms. Inouye's testimony it believed. It never even made credibility determinations for this court to rely on. So it'd be difficult, I think, to decide the deficiency prong without more information and factual development on that prong. But if I might just go back to Judge Edwards' question about the Sixth Circuit, I would note for this court that the Sixth Circuit is analyzing a habeas case under Michigan law. So the impact of that decision, and I would note that Judge Martin specifically references a prior Court of Appeals decision in a self-defense case saying that under Michigan law, the Court of Appeals would find that duress involves a subjective inquiry. And if you read Judge Guy's dissent into the Sixth Circuit, he says, we never even talked about the standard here. And Judge Guy says the standard in Michigan is an objective standard. It's not what a reasonably prudent battered woman would do. It's what a reasonably prudent person would do. And that's why Judge
Guy
dissents.
What's the logic behind allowing battered woman syndrome for self-defense but not duress?
Well, in self-defense, the state of mind of how the threat is perceived by the individual is obviously a key issue in the case. And one of the things that's key about self-defense is we're talking about a defendant who is now attacking someone who has repeatedly attacked her. Duress, we're saying, okay, we're going to take that relationship and allow that to excuse criminal conduct that you admit that you did towards third parties. And that seems very different from a legal standpoint as to what society in these justification
why
defenses.
Why not allow juries to sort that out with the expert testimony and the testimony that you would no doubt give in opposition to that in the ordinary case rather than excluding it categorically?
It's the judge's role as a gatekeeper, as the Supreme Court held in the duress, one of its very first duress cases, to make sure that there's a sufficient factual basis here. This is powerful testimony that can certainly be very sympathetic. And so the judge's role is to make sure that there's
your
a sufficient factual basis.
Your positions are so inconsistent because the first time up you said, and the court found, the expert information wasn't there. And now you're essentially saying there can be no such defense, which makes no sense to me.
I think the first time around, the focus was on what was the missing factual components. All a battered women expert does is to give a different veneer at which you look at those missing factual components. But they're still missing. It's not a Band-Aid to solve the missing factual issues.
The explanation is that the woman is incapacitated.
And
you're assessing the facts pursuant to how you might deal with the situation. And that's obvious that you're right. It would be unreasonable for you to not call someone. But that's not what this is all about. This is about someone who allegedly was incapacitated because she was battered. And the expert's explanation as to what that means says she did not have the capacity. And you can't just say, well, on Tuesday she made a call here or whatever. You need someone to explain it to the jury and let the jury sort it out. Battered women are in a terrible situation.
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor. I would note, though, that it's not the government's opinion. It's this court's precedent that has made it very clear that the subjective, what's inside the defendant's mind, is just not something we're willing to look behind. We're not willing to look into their head and ask, what were they thinking and was that reasonable? And that is Jenrette. If this court decides that it wants to allow BWS testimony to go to whether or not the individual, the defendant, actually had a reasonable legal alternative, then it should review Jenrette and say, why aren't we asking whether Congressman Jenrette's alcoholism and fear of mobsters was the reason why for 2 days he didn't go to authorities? That's the same question that he posed. He said, I am an alcoholic and I'm crazy, you know, so that's why I didn't go to the police. The court said we're not willing to look at that.
If I recall, he was pretty crazy. Not just in this case. You're too young to remember.
Unless there are any other questions, the government respectfully requests this court to affirm the ruling of the district court.
Thank you. I'll give you a few minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few quick things.
The case that I was referring to about habeas is Jones versus Cunningham. It's at page 35 of my brief where the court stated that the Supreme Court that had repeatedly held that habeas is available to an alien seeking entry into the United States. So I think that it's even more important, the converse. Information, there's a couple of things the government said that are not correct. In June 2006, she testified that she waited until Osuagu had moved out of the house they were sharing when she thought she might be safe enough to go to the authorities. So it was not true that he was still living with her at the time. He had moved out. The question about the eligibility for CJA funds, about a remand, until the government had not disputed this in the district court during the 2255 proceedings because she had been determined to be eligible for CJA, appointment of counsel, a finding that was not revoked. It's on the docket sheet in the appendix. So she was eligible for CJA funds, and that was never argued below.
Does the government even raise that in their brief?
No, they do raise it, I would say, obliquely in their brief. But it was not contested below, and she, in fact, had been determined to be eligible. And then finally, about the deportation or the removal, I looked during the I can't find it. It was clearly mentioned at the first evidentiary hearing that until the proceedings were concluded, she was under a removal order, but the proceedings, and it's in the transcript somewhere, and because there's several hundred pages. The reason is, it wasn't, when it was said to Judge Huvel, I believe, it was at that hearing, the government didn't dispute it, so there was no argument about it. And then it was in my brief about the quorum novus, and until today, that's the first I heard that there may be a question about that. It's in the record. And undisputed.
Okay.
It's in the record and undisputed until this morning's argument, and I would have put something more in the brief had I known it was in.
Counsel emphasized the Jenrette case. You want to distinguish that?
Sure. I mean, I think he met with these two people he claimed he thought were mobsters. But they didn't threaten him in any way. There was no threats. They didn't hit him. They didn't threaten him to do anything to him. He said, give me a day or two to think it over. And they didn't say anything to him about any kind of threat at all. And then he took another day or two to agree to it. So this court said he had ample opportunity to go to the authorities in those intervening days. And it was either 2 or 3 days, I'm not sure. But he never claimed that anybody had threatened him. He claimed he had a belief that they were mobsters somehow. But they had not said a word to him, a threatening word to him, so there was no danger of an imminent threat, nor was there a danger. Did he have any belief that he couldn't go to the authorities, reasonable belief? Mrs. Inouye had both. She was under, not only was she under an imminent threat, and the government talked about death, but the test actually is imminent threat of death or bodily injury. Not only was she under an immediate threat, she actually, when she said no at the beginning of this, he had beaten her before that. But when she said no when he first proposed this, he beat her. She said head, body, and shoulders. So she had the threat, and every time he beat her once for not answering the door while she was asleep. He beat her at every opportunity. So there was a reasonable threat of imminent danger and imminent bodily. And then the answer to the Jenrette case is, and of course he just said all this. He didn't present any expert testimony of any kind. The difference is could he have? Because the difference in the battered woman syndrome is this, what's called learned helplessness, the utter control by the batterer, which is reasonable.
Counsel says that there should be a distinction, however, between self-defense and duress because of your committing criminal conduct on a third party.
First of all, there's a legion of cases. There's fraud cases, there's drug cases. So there's a number of cases that don't make that distinction at all. If you are suffering from battered woman syndrome, which Ms. Inouye was, according to Dr. Ginter, there is no difference. When the batterer tells you to do something, you're under that, as she testified and as Dr. Ginter testified at length, you're under their complete control. You cannot do anything else. And whether you take action against the batterer eventually, or whether you do what the batterer said to prevent that, your reasonable fear of imminent bodily injury or death, and he threatened to kill her, either one is under the control. The distinction doesn't make any sense to me, nor have courts drawn any such distinction. There's a number of cases cited in my brief, both drug cases, there's a welfare fraud case, there's another fraud case, that make no such distinction about whether the criminal act is against the batterer or some other kind of criminal act, such as a drug case or a fraud case. So I think that is a distinction without a difference, let me put it that way, in a battered woman syndrome case. Thank you very much.
Thank you to both counsel. The case is submitted.